The only other kid he recognized was Jack, who by then had been living on their street for a month. Although Nath had not yet come to hate him, he already sensed that they would not be friends. At 7, Jack was tall and lanky, freckled and bold, afraid of nothing. James, not attuned to the sensitivities of the playground, was suddenly annoyed at his son's shyness, his reluctance. The confident young man in his imagination dwindled to a nervous little boy, skinny, small, hunched so deeply that his chest was concave. And though he would not admit it, Nath, legs twisted, stacking the toes of one foot atop the other, reminded him of himself at that age.
"We came here to swim," James said. "Mrs. Allen is watching your sister just so you could learn the breaststroke, Nathan. Don't waste everyone's time."
He tugged the towel from his son's grasp and steered him firmly toward the water, hovering over him until he slid in. Then he sat down on the vacant poolside bench, nudging aside discarded flippers and goggles.
"It's good for him," James thought. "He needs to learn how to make friends."
Nath circled the girl who was it with the other children, bouncing on his toes to keep his head above water. It took James a few minutes to recognize Jack, and when he did, it was with a twinge of admiration. Jack was a good swimmer, cocky and confident in the water, weaving around the others, shining and breathless. "He must have walked over by himself," James decided. All spring, Vivian Allen had been whispering about Janet Wolfe, how she left Jack alone while she worked at the hospital.
"Maybe we can give him a ride home," he thought. "He could stay to play at our house until his mother finishes her shift."
He would be a nice friend for Nath, a good role model. He imagined Nath and Jack inseparable, rigging a tire swing in the backyard, biking through the neighborhood.
In his own school days, he'd been embarrassed to ask classmates to his house, afraid that they'd recognize his mother from the lunch line, or his father from mopping the hallway. They hadn't had a yard anyway.
Maybe they would play pirates. Jack as the captain and Nath as the first mate. Sheriff and deputy. Batman and Robin.
By the time James focused his attention back on the pool, Nath was it. But something was wrong.
The other children glided away. Silently, stifling giggles, they hoisted themselves out of the water and onto the tile surround. Eyes closed, Nath drifted all alone in the middle of the pool, wading in small circles, feeling his way through the water with his hands. James could hear him.
"Marco! Marco! Polo!"
the others called back. They circled the shallow end, splashing the water with their hands, and Nath moved from one side to the other, following the sounds of motion.
"Marco! Marco!"
a plaintive note in his voice now.
It wasn't personal, James told himself. They'd been playing for who knows how long. They were just tired of the game. They were just messing around. Nothing to do with Nath.
Then an older girl, maybe 10 or 11, shouted,
"Chink can't find China!"
And the other children laughed. A rock formed and sank in James's belly. In the pool, Nath paused, arms outstretched on the surface of the water, uncertain how to proceed. One hand opened and closed in silence. On the sidelines, his father, too, was uncertain. Could he make the children get back in the pool? Saying anything would draw attention to the trick. He could call his son. "It's time to go home," he might say. Then Nath would open his eyes and see nothing but water all around him. The smell of chlorine began to bite at James's nostrils. Then, on the far side of the pool, he saw the blur of a body sliding silently into the water. A figure glided toward Nath. A sandy head broke the surface. Jack.
Polo! Jack shouted.
The sound echoed off the tiled walls.
Polo! Polo! Polo!
Giddy with relief, Nath lunged, and Jack held still, treading water, waiting until Nath caught his shoulder. For a moment, James saw sheer joy on his son's face. The dark furrow of frustration wiped away. Then Nath opened his eyes, and the glow vanished. He saw the other kids squatting around the pool, laughing now. The pool empty except for Jack in front of him. Jack himself turned to Nath and grinned. To Nath, it was a taunt.
Joke's on you.
He shoved Jack aside and ducked underwater. And when he reemerged at the edge, he climbed straight out without shaking himself. He didn't even wipe the water from his eyes, just let it stream over his face as he stalked toward the door. And because of this, James could not tell if he was crying. In the locker room, Nath refused to say a word. He refused to put his clothes or even his shoes on. And when James held out his slacks for the third time, Nath kicked the locker so hard he left a dent in the door. James glanced back over his shoulder and saw Jack peeking through the door from the pool area. He wondered if Jack was about to speak, maybe apologize. But instead, he stood silent and staring. Nath, who hadn't spotted Jack at all, marched out into the lobby, and James bundled up their things and let the door swing shut behind them. Part of him wanted to gather his son into his arms, to tell him that he understood. Even after almost 30 years, he still remembered P.E. class at Lloyd. How once he'd gotten tangled up in his shirt and emerged to find his pants missing from the bench. Everyone else had already dressed and was stuffing gym uniforms into lockers and lacing shoes. He had tiptoed back into the gym, hiding his bare thighs and calves behind his knapsack, looking for Mr. Childs, the P.E. teacher. By then, the bell had rung and the locker room had emptied. After 10 minutes of searching, mortified at being in his undershorts in front of Mr. Childs, his pants were revealed under a sink, legs tied around the U-bend, dust bunnies caught in the cuffs.
"Probably just got mixed up in someone else's things," Mr. Childs had said. "Hurry along to class now, Lee. You're tardy."
James had known it was no accident. After that, he had developed a system. Pants first, then shirt. He had never told anyone about it, but the memory clung. So part of him wanted to tell Nath that he knew what it was like to be teased, what it was like to never fit in. The other part of him wanted to shake his son, to slap him, to shape him into something different. Later, when Nath was too slight for the football team, too short for the basketball team, too clumsy for the baseball team, when he seemed to prefer reading and poring over his atlas and peering through his telescope to making friends, James would think back to this day in the swimming pool. This first disappointment in his son, this first and most painful puncture in his fatherly dreams. That afternoon, though, he let Nath run up to his room and slam the door. At dinner time, when he knocked to offer a Salisbury steak, Nath did not respond. And downstairs, James allowed Lydia to nestle against him on the couch and watch the Jackie Gleason show. What could he say to comfort his son? It will get better. He could not bring himself to lie. Better just to forget the whole thing. When Marilyn arrived home early Sunday morning,
Nath sat sullen and silent at the breakfast table, and James said merely with a wave of the hand,
"Some kids teased him at the pool yesterday. He needs to learn to take a joke."
Nath bristled and glared at his father. But James, cringing at the memory of all he had left out, Chink can't find China, didn't notice. And neither did his mother, who, preoccupied, set bowls and the box of cornflakes in front of them. At this last outrage, finally, Nath broke his silence.
"I want a hard-boiled egg," he insisted.
Marilyn, to everyone's surprise, burst into tears. And in the end, subdued and unprotesting, they all ate cereal anyway. It was clear to the entire family, however, that something had changed in their mother. For the rest of the day, her mood was sulky and stormy. At dinner, though they all anticipated a roast chicken or a meatloaf or a pot roast, a real meal at last, after so many Swanson's dinners warmed in the oven, Marilyn opened a can of chicken noodle soup, a can of SpaghettiOs. The next morning, after the children went to school, Marilyn pulled a scrap of paper from her dresser drawer. Tom Lawson's phone number still stood out, sharp black against the pale blue college rule.
"Tom," she said when he answered. "Dr. Lawson, it's Marilyn Lee."
When he didn't reply, she added, "James Lee's wife. We met at the Christmas party. We talked about me maybe working in your lab." A pause. Then, to Marilyn's surprise, laughter.
"I hired an undergrad months ago," Tom Lawson said. "I had no idea you were actually serious about that, with your children and your husband and all."
Marilyn hung up without bothering to reply. For a long time, she stood in the kitchen by the phone, staring through the window. Outside, it no longer felt like spring. The wind had turned biting and dry. The daffodils, tricked by the warm weather, bent their faces to the ground. All across the garden, they lay prostrate, stems broken, yellow trumpets withered. Marilyn wiped the table and pulled the crossword puzzle toward her, trying to forget the amusement in Tom Lawson's voice. The newsprint clung to the damp wood, and as she wrote in her first answer, the pen tore through the paper, leaving a blue A on the tabletop. She took her car keys down from their hook and lifted her handbag from the entry table. At first, she told herself she was just going out to clear her head. Despite the chill, she rolled the window down, and as she circled the lake once, twice, the breeze snaked its way beneath her hair to the nape of her neck.
"With your children and husband and all."
She drove without thinking, all the way through Middlewood, past the campus and the grocery store and the roller rink. And only when she found herself turning into the hospital parking lot did she realize this was where she'd intended to come all along. Inside, Marilyn settled in the corner of the waiting room. Someone had painted the room, walls, ceiling, doors, a pale, calming blue. White-hatted, white-skirted nurses glided in and out like clouds, bearing syringes of insulin, bottles of pills, rolls of gauze. Candy stripers buzzed by with carts of lunch trays. And the doctors? They strode unhurried through the bustle like jets cutting their steady way through the sky. Whenever they appeared, heads turned toward them. Anxious husbands and hysterical mothers and tentative daughters stood up at their approach. They were all men, Marilyn noticed. Dr. Kenger, Dr. Gordon, Dr. McClenahan, Dr. Stone. What had made her think she could be one of them?
It seemed as impossible as turning into a tiger. Then, through the double doors from the emergency room, a slender, dark-haired figure, hair pulled back in a neat bun. For a moment, Marilyn could not place her. "Dr. Wolf," one of the nurses called, lifting a clipboard from the counter, and Dr. Wolf crossed the room to take it, her heels clacking on the linoleum. Marilyn had seen Janet Wolf only once or twice since she'd moved in a month before, but she would not have recognized her anyway. She had heard that Janet Wolf worked at the hospital. Vivian Allen, leaning over the garden fence, had whispered about late shifts. The Wolf boy left to run wild. But she had pictured a secretary, a nurse. Not this graceful woman, no older than she, tall in black slacks, a white doctor's coat loose around her slim frame. This Dr. Wolf, a stethoscope looped around her neck like a shining silver necklace, who with expert hands touched and turned the bruised wrist of a workman, who called clear and confident across the room, "Dr. Gordon, may I have a word with you about your patient, please?" And Dr. Gordon put down his clipboard and came. It was not her imagination. Everyone repeated it, like a mantra. "Dr. Wolf, Dr. Wolf, Dr. Wolf." The nurses, bottles of penicillin in hand, "Dr. Wolf, a quick question." The candy stripers as they passed by, "Good morning, Dr. Wolf." Most miraculous of all, the other doctors.
"Dr. Wolf, could I ask your opinion, please?"
"Dr. Wolf, you're needed in patient room 2.
Only then did Marilyn finally believe. How was it possible? How had she managed it? She thought of her mother's cookbook. "Make somebody happy today. Bake a cake. Bake a cake. Have a party. Bake a cake to take to a party. Bake a cake just because you feel good today." She pictured her mother creaming shortening and sugar, sifting flour, greasing a pan. "Is there anything that gives you a deeper sense of satisfaction?" There was Janet Wolf striding across the hospital waiting room, her coat so white it glowed. Of course it was possible for her. She had no husband. She let her son run wild. Without a husband, without children, perhaps it would have been possible. "I could have done that," Marilyn thought. And the words clicked into place like puzzle pieces, shocking her with their rightness. The hypothetical past perfect. Tense of missed chances. Tears dripped down her chin. "No," she thought suddenly. "I could do that." And then, to her embarrassment and horror, there was Janet Wolf before her, bending solicitously in front of her chair. "Marilyn," she said. "It's Marilyn, right? Mrs. Lee?" To which Marilyn replied the only words in her mind. "Dr. Wolf." "What's wrong?" Dr. Wolf asked. "Are you ill?" Up close, her face was surprisingly young. Beneath her powder, a faint constellation of freckles still dotted her nose. Her hand, gentle on Marilyn's shoulder, was steady and assured, and so was her smile. "Everything will be fine," it seemed to say. Marilyn shook her head. "No, no, everything's fine." She looked up at Janet Wolf. "Thank you." And she meant it. The next evening, after a dinner of canned ravioli and canned vegetable soup, she planned it out in her mind. She had all of her mother's savings, enough for a few months. When her mother's house was sold, she would have more, enough for a few years at least. In a year, she could finish her degree. It would prove that she still could, that it was not too late. After that, at last, she would apply to medical school. Only 8 years later than planned. While the children were at school, she drove an hour to the community college outside Toledo and enrolled in organic chemistry, advanced statistics, anatomy. Everything she'd planned for her last semesters. The next day, she made the drive again and found a furnished efficiency near the campus, signing a lease for the 1st of May. 2 weeks away. Every night when she was alone, she read the cookbook again, steeling herself with her mother's small and lonely life. You don't want this, she reminded herself. There will be more to your life than this. Lydia and Nath would be fine, she told herself again and again. She would not let herself think otherwise. James would be there. Look how they had managed while she was in Virginia. It was still possible. In the quiet dark, she packed her old college textbooks into cartons and tucked them in the attic, ready to go. As May approached, she cooked lavish meal after lavish meal. Swedish meatballs, beef stroganoff, chicken a la king. Everything James and the children liked best. Everything from scratch, just as her mother had taught her. She baked a pink birthday cake for Lydia and let her eat as much as she wanted. On the 1st of May, after Sunday dinner, she sealed leftovers in Tupperware and put them in the freezer. She baked batch after batch of cookies.
It's like you're preparing for a famine, James said, laughing.
And Marilyn smiled back, a fake smile, the same one she had given to her mother all those years. You lifted the corners of your mouth toward your ears. You kept your lips closed. It was amazing how no one could tell. That night, in bed, she wrapped her arms around James, kissed the side of his neck, undressed him slowly, as she had when they were younger. She tried to memorize the curve of his back and the hollow at the base of his spine, as if he were a landscape she would never see again. Beginning to cry, silently at first, and then, as their bodies collided again and again, more fiercely.
What is it?
James whispered, stroking her cheek.
What's wrong?
Marilyn shook her head, and he pulled her close, their bodies sticky and damp.
It's okay, he said, kissing her forehead. Everything will be better tomorrow.
In the morning, Marilyn burrowed beneath the covers, listening to James dress. The zip as he fastened his trousers, the clink as he buckled his belt. Even with her eyes closed, she could see him straightening his collar, smoothing the cowlick in his hair, which still, after all these years, made him look a bit like a schoolboy. She kept them closed when he came to kiss her goodbye, because if she saw him, she knew the tears would come again. At the bus stop, later that morning, she knelt on the sidewalk and kissed Nath and Lydia each on the cheek, not daring to look into their eyes. Be good, she told them. Behave. I love you. After the bus had disappeared around the curve of the lake, she visited her daughter's room, then her son's. From Lydia's dresser, she took a single barrette, cherry-colored bakelite with a white flower, one of a pair she seldom wore. From the cigar box beneath Nath's bed, she took a marble, not his favorite, the cobalt with white specks like stars, but one of the little dark ones, the ones he called oilies. From the inside of James's overcoat, the old one he'd worn in her college days, She snipped the spare button from the underside of the lapel. A tiny token from each, tucked into the pocket of her dress. A gesture that would resurface in her youngest child years later. Though Marilyn would never mention this small theft to Hannah, or to anyone. Not something treasured and loved, something they might miss but would not grieve. No need to tear another hole, even a pinprick in their lives. Then Marilyn took her boxes from their hiding place in the attic and sat down to write James a note. But how did you write something like this? It seemed wrong to write to him on her stationery, as if he were a stranger. More wrong still to write it on the scratch pad in the kitchen, as if it were no more important than a grocery list. At last, she pulled a blank sheet from the typewriter and sat down at her vanity with a pen. I realize that I am not happy with the life I lead. I always had one kind of life in mind, and things have turned out very differently. Marilyn took a deep, ragged breath. I have kept all these feelings inside me for a long time. But now, after being in my mother's house again, I think of her and realize I cannot put them aside any longer. I know you'll be fine without me. She paused, trying to convince herself this was true. I hope you can understand why I have to leave. I hope you can forgive me. For a long time, Marilyn sat, ballpoint in hand, unsure how to finish. In the end, she tore up the note and tossed the shreds into the waste paper basket. Better, she decided, just to go. To disappear from their lives as if she had never been there. To Nath and Lydia, who that afternoon found themselves unmet at the bus stop, who let themselves into an unlocked and empty house, that was exactly how it seemed. Their father, when he came home 2 hours later to find his children huddled on the front steps, as if they were afraid to be in the house alone, kept asking questions. What do you mean, gone? He asked Nath, who could only repeat, gone, the only word he could find. Lydia, meanwhile, said nothing at all during the confused rest of the evening, in which their father called the police and then all the neighbors, but forgot about dinner and bedtime, as the policeman took note after note until she and Nath fell asleep on the living room floor. She awoke in the middle of the night in her own bed, where her father had deposited her, shoes still on, and felt for the diary her mother had given her at Christmas. At last, something important had occurred, something that she ought to write down. But she did not know how to explain what had happened. How everything had changed in just one day. How someone she loved so dearly could be there one minute, and the next minute, gone. 5. Hannah knows nothing about that summer, of her mother's long-ago disappearance. For as long as she's been alive, the family has never spoken of it, and even if they had, it would have changed nothing. She is furious with her sister for vanishing, bewildered that Lydia would leave them all behind. Knowing would only have made her more furious, more bewildered. How could you, she would have thought, when you knew what it was like? As it is, imagining her sister sinking into the lake, all she can think now is, how? And what was it like? Tonight she will find out. Again, it is 2 a.m. by her glow-in-the-dark clock. All night she has lain patiently, watching the numbers tick by. Today, June 1st. Should have been her last day of school. Tomorrow, Nath was supposed to walk across the stage in his blue robe and mortarboard and collect his diploma. But they're not going to Nath's commencement. Neither of them has gone back to school since. Her mind silences the thought. She takes the squeaky sixth stair on her toes. She skips the middle rosette in the front hall carpet and the creaky floorboard beneath, landing cat-soft just at the door. Although upstairs Marilyn and James and Nath all lie awake, searching for sleep, no one hears. Hannah's body knows all the secrets of silence. In the dark, her fingers slide back the bolt, then grasp the safety chain and unfasten it without rattling. This last is a new trick. Before the funeral, there was no chain. She's been practicing this for 3 weeks now, toying with the lock whenever her mother wasn't looking. Now Hannah oozes her body around the door and steps barefoot onto the lawn, where Lydia must have been on her last night alive. Overhead, the moon hovers behind tree branches, and the yard and the walkway and the other houses slowly appear out of the grainy dark. This is what her sister would have seen that night. Glints of moonlight reflected in Mrs. Allen's window panes. The mailboxes all leaning slightly away. The faint glimmer of the street lamp on the corner, where the main road loops around the lake. At the edge of the lawn, Hannah stops, toes on the sidewalk, heels still on the grass, and pictures that thin figure marching into the shadows. She had not looked afraid. So Hannah heads straight down the middle of the road, too, where the yellow line would be if their street were busy enough to need one. Through the darkened windows, the pale linings of curtains glow. There are no lights anywhere on their street, except for Mrs. Allen's front door light, which she leaves on all the time, even during the day. When Hannah was younger, she had thought adults stayed up late every night. Until 2 or 3, perhaps. She adds this to the list of things she's learned are untrue. At the corner she stops, but sees only darkness both ways. No cars. Her eyes are used to the dark now, and she darts across the main road and onto the grassy bank of the lake. But she still can't see it. Only the slope of the ground tells her that she's getting close. She passes a clump of birches, all holding their stiff arms above their heads, as if in surrender. Then, suddenly, her toes find the water. Below the low thrum of a high-up airplane, she hears it. A faint lapping against her ankles, soft as the sound of her own tongue in her mouth. If she looks very hard, she can see a faint shimmer, like silver tulle. Except for that, she would not have known that this was water. "A beautiful location," the realtor had told James and Marilyn when they had first moved to Middlewood. Hannah has heard this story many times. 5 minutes to the grocery store and the bank, and think of it, the lake practically at your doorstep. He had glanced at Marilyn's rounded belly. "You and the kiddos can swim all summer, like having your own private beach." James, charmed, had agreed. All her life, Hannah has loved this lake. Now it is a new place. The dock, smoothed by years of use, is the same silvery gray by moonlight that it is in the day. At the end, one small lamp, set on a post, stretches its light over a thin circle of the water. She will set out in the boat, as Lydia must have. She will row to the middle of the lake, where her sister somehow ended up, and peer down into the water. Maybe then she'll understand. But the boat is gone. The city, belatedly cautious, has taken it away. Hannah sinks back onto her heels and imagines her sister kneeling to unknot the rope, then pushing the boat away from the shore, so far out you couldn't tell the water from the darkness around it. At last, she lies down on the dock, rocking herself gently, looking up into the night sky. It is as close to her sister's last night as she can get. If this were another summer, the lake would still be a lovely place. Nath and Lydia would don swimsuits and spread towels across the grass. Lydia, gleaming with baby oil, would stretch out in the sun. If Hannah were very lucky, she would be allowed to rub a squirt of oil on her own arms, to retie the strings of Lydia's bikini after she had tanned her back. Nath would cannonball off the dock, spraying a fine mist that would bead up on their skin like pearls. On the very best days, though those were very, very rare, their parents would come too. Their father would practice his breaststroke and his Australian crawl, and if he was in a good mood, he'd take Hannah out over her head, steadying her as she kicked. Their mother, shaded by a huge sun hat, would look up from her New Yorker when Hannah returned to the towel and let her curl quietly against her shoulder to peep at the cartoons. These things happened only at the lake. They won't go to the lake this summer at all. They will never go again. She knows without having to ask. Her father has spent the past 3 weeks in his office, although the university had offered to have someone else finish out the term. Her mother has spent hours and hours in Lydia's room, looking and looking at everything, but touching nothing. Nath roams the house like a caged beast, opening cupboards and shutting them, picking up one book after another, then tossing them down again. Hannah doesn't say a word. These are the new rules, which no one has outlined, but which she already knows. Don't talk about Lydia. Don't talk about the lake. Don't ask questions. She lies still for a long time, picturing her sister on the lake bed. Her face would point straight up, like this, studying the underside of the water. Her arms would stretch out, like this, as if she were embracing the whole world. She would listen and listen, waiting for them to come and find her. "We didn't know," Hannah thinks. "We would have come." It doesn't help. She still doesn't understand. Back home, Hannah tiptoes into Lydia's room and shuts the door. Then she lifts the dust ruffle and pulls out the slim velvet box hidden beneath the bed. Under the tent of Lydia's blanket, she opens the box and pulls out a silver locket. Their father had given it to Lydia for her birthday, but she had tucked it under her bed, letting the velvet grow shaggy with dust. The necklace is broken now. But anyway, Hannah has promised Lydia that she will never put it on, and she does not break promises to people she loves, even if they aren't alive anymore. Instead, she rubs the fine chain between her fingers like a rosary. The bed smells like her sister sleeping, a warm and musky and sharp smell, like a wild animal that emerged only when she was deep in slumber. She can almost feel the imprint of her sister's body in the mattress, wrapping her like a hug. In the morning, when the sunlight comes through the window, she remakes the bed and replaces the locket and returns to her room. Without thinking, she knows she will do this again the next night, and the next, and the next, smoothing the blanket when she wakes, stepping carefully over the scattered shoes and clothes as she makes her way to the door. At breakfast time, Nath comes downstairs to find his parents arguing, and he stops in the hallway just outside the kitchen.
"Unlocked all night," his mother is saying, "and you don't even care."
It wasn't unlocked. The bolt was on. By the sharp little edges in his father's voice, He can tell this conversation has been going on for some time. Someone could have gotten in. I put that chain on for a reason. Nath tiptoes into the doorway. But his parents, Marilyn bent over the sink, James hunched in his chair, don't look up. On the far side of the table, Hannah squirms over her toast and milk. I'm sorry, she thinks as hard as she can. I forgot the chain. I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Her parents don't notice. In fact, they act as if she isn't even there. Silence for a long moment. Then James says, You really think a chain on the door would have changed anything? Marilyn clunks her teacup hard against the counter. She would never have gone out on her own. I know she wouldn't. Sneaking out in the middle of the night? My Lydia? Never. She rings the china with both hands. Someone took her out there. Some nutcase. James sighs, a deep, trembling sigh, as if he's struggling to lift a very heavy weight. For the past 3 weeks, Marilyn has been saying things like this. The morning after the funeral, he woke up just after sunrise, and everything came rushing back to him. The glossy casket, Louisa's skin slick against his, the soft little moan she had made as he climbed atop her. And he suddenly felt grimy, as if he were caked with mud. He turned the shower on hot, so hot he couldn't stand still beneath it and had to keep turning, like something on a spit, offering the steaming spray a new patch of flesh again and again. It hadn't helped. And when he came out of the bathroom, a faint scratching noise led him to the bottom of the stairs, where Marilyn was installing the chain on the front door. He had wanted to say what had been growing in his mind for days. What had happened to Lydia was nothing they could lock out or scare away. Then the look on Marilyn's face stopped him. Sad and frightened, but angry too, as if he were to blame for something. For a moment she seemed like a different woman, a stranger. He had swallowed hard and touched his collar, buttoning it over his throat. Well, he said, I'm going into school. My summer class. When he leaned in to kiss her, she flinched away as if his touch burned. On the front porch, the paper boy had deposited a newspaper. Local family lays daughter to rest. He still has it locked in the bottom drawer of his desk. As one of only two Orientals at Middlewood High, the other being her brother Nathan, Lee stood out in the halls. However, few seemed to have known her well. Every day since then, there have been more articles. Any death is a sensation in a small town, but the death of a young girl is a journalistic gold mine. Police still searching for clues in girl's death. Suicide, likely possibility, investigators say. Each time he sees one, he folds the newsprint over itself, as if wrapping up something rotten, before Marilyn or the children spot it. Only in the safety of his office does he unroll the paper to read it carefully. Then he adds it to the growing stack in the locked drawer. Now he bows his head. I don't think that's what happened. Marilyn bristles. What are you suggesting? Before James can answer, the doorbell rings. It is the police. And as the two officers step into the kitchen, Nath and Hannah simultaneously let out their breaths. At last, their parents will stop arguing.
We just wanted to give you folks an update, says the older one. Officer Fisk, Nath remembers.
He pulls a notebook from his pocket and nudges his glasses up with a stubby finger.
Everyone at the station is truly sorry for your loss.
We just want to find out what happened.
Of course, officer,
James murmurs. We've spoken to the people you listed. Officer Fisk consults his notebook. Karen Adler, Pam Saunders, Shelley Brierly. They all said they barely knew her.
Hannah watches redness spread across her father's face, like a rash.
We've talked to a number of Lydia's classmates and teachers as well. From what we can tell, she didn't have many friends.
Officer Fisk looks up.
Would you say Lydia was a lonely girl?
Lonely? James glances at his wife. Then, for the first time that morning, at his son.
As one of only two Orientals at Middlewood High, the other being her brother Nathan, Lee stood out in the halls.
He knows that feeling. All those faces, fish pale and silent and staring. He had tried to tell himself that Lydia was different, that all those friends made her just one of the crowd.
Lonely, he says again, slowly. She did spend a lot of time alone.
She was so busy, Marilyn interrupts. She worked very hard in her classes, a lot of homework to do, a lot of studying.
She looks earnestly from one policeman to the other, as if afraid they won't believe her.
She was very smart.
Did she seem sad at all these past few weeks? The younger officer asks. Did she ever give any sign she might want to hurt herself, or...
Marilyn doesn't even wait for him to finish.
Lydia was very happy. She loved school. She could have done anything. She'd never go out in that boat by herself.
Her hands start to shake, and she clutches the teacup again, trying to keep them steady. So tightly, Hannah thinks she might squeeze it to pieces.
Why aren't you looking for whoever took her out there?
There's no evidence of anyone else in the boat with her, says Officer Fisk. Or on the dock.
How can you tell? Marilyn insists. My Lydia would never have gone out in a boat alone.
Tea sloshes onto the counter.
You just never know these days who's waiting around the corner for you.
Marilyn, James says.
Read the paper. There are psychos everywhere these days. Kidnapping people, shooting them, raping them.
What does it take for the police to start tracking them down?
Marilyn, James says again, louder this time.
We're looking into all possibilities, Officer Fisk says gently.
We know you are, says James. You're doing all you can. Thank you.
He glances at Marilyn.
We can't ask for more than that.
Marilyn opens her mouth again, then closes it without a word. The policemen glance at each other. Then the younger one says,
We'd like to ask Nathan a few more questions, if that's okay. Alone?
Five faces swivel toward Nath, and his cheeks go hot.
Me?
Just a couple of follow-ups, says Officer Fisk.
He puts his hand on Nath's shoulder.
Maybe we can just step out onto the front porch.
When Officer Fisk has shut the front door behind them, Nath props himself against the railing. Under his palms, a few shreds of paint work loose and flutter to the porch floor. He has been wrestling with the idea of calling the police himself, of telling them about Jack, and how he must be responsible. In another town or another time, they might have shared Nath's suspicions already. Or if Lydia herself had been different, a Shelley Brierly, a Pam Saunders, a Karen Adler, a normal teenage girl, a girl they understood. The police might have looked at Jack more closely, pieced together a history of small complaints, teachers protesting graffitied desks and insolent remarks, other brothers taking umbrage at his liberties with their sisters. They might have listened to Nath's complaints, after school all spring every day,
and come to similar conclusions. A girl and a boy. So much time together alone. It would not be so hard to understand, after all, why Nath eyed Jack so closely and bitterly. They, like Nath, might have found suspicious signs in everything Jack has ever said or done. But they won't. It complicates the story. And the story, as it emerges from the teachers and the kids at school, is so obvious. Lydia's quietness, her lack of friends, her recent sinking grades, and, in truth, the strangeness of her family. A family with no friends. A family of misfits. All this shines so brightly that in the eyes of the police, Jack falls into shadow. A girl like that and a boy like him, who can have, does have, any girl he wants. It is impossible for them to imagine what Nath knows to be true, let alone what he himself imagines. To his men, Officer Fisk often says, "When you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras." Nath, they would have said, is only hysterical, hearing zebras everywhere. Now, face to face with the police, Nath can see that there is no point in mentioning Jack at all. They have already decided who is to blame. Officer Fisk settles himself against the railing, too.
"We just wanted to chat a little, Nathan, in private. Maybe you'll think of something you forgot. Sometimes brothers and sisters know things about each other their parents don't, you know?"
Nath tries to agree, but nothing comes out. He nods. Today, he suddenly remembers, should have been his graduation.
"Was Lydia in the habit of sneaking out alone?"
Officer Fisk asks.
"There's no need to worry. You're not in trouble. Just tell us what you know."
He keeps saying "just," as if it's a tiny favor he wants, a little offhand thing. "Talk to us. Tell us her secrets. Tell us everything." Nath starts to tremble. He's positive the policeman can see him shaking.
"Had she ever snuck out by herself before at night?"
the younger policeman asks. Nath swallows, tries to hold himself still.
"No," he croaks. "No, never."
The policemen glance at each other. Then the younger one perches on the railing beside Nath, like a kid leaning against a locker before school, as if they're friends. This is his role, Nath realizes, to act like the buddy, to coax him to talk. His shoes are polished so bright they reflect the sun, a blurry smudge of light at each big toe.
"Did Lydia usually get along with your parents?"
The policeman shifts his weight, and the railing creaks.
"Maybe you should join some clubs too, honey, meet some new people. Would you like to take a summer class? That could be fun."
"Our parents?" Nath says.
He hardly recognizes the voice that comes out as his.
"Sure, she did. Did you ever see either of them hit her?" "Hit her?"
Lydia, so fussed over, so carefully tended, like a prize flower. The one perpetually on their mother's mind. Even when she was reading, dog-earing pages of articles Lydia might like. The one their father kissed first every night when he came home.
"My parents would never hit Lydia. They loved her." "Did she ever talk about hurting herself?"
The porch railing starts to blur. All he can do is shake his head, hard. "No, no, no."
"Did she seem upset the night before she disappeared?"
Nath tries to think. He had wanted to tell her about college. The lush green leaves against the deep red brick. How much fun it was going to be. How for the first time in his life, he'd stood up straight. how from that new angle the world had looked bigger, wider, brighter. Except she had been silent all dinner, and afterward she'd gone right up to her room. He had thought she was tired. He had thought, I'll tell her tomorrow. And suddenly, to his horror, he begins to cry. Wet, messy tears that dribble down his nose and into the collar of his shirt. Both policemen turn away then, and Officer Fisk closes his notebook and fishes in his pocket for a handkerchief. Keep it, he says, holding it out to Nath. And he squeezes him on the shoulder once, hard, and then they're gone. Inside, Marilyn says to James, So I have to ask your permission now to speak in company? That's not what I meant. James props his elbows on the table and rests his forehead on his hands. You just can't go making wild accusations. You can't go berating the police. Who's berating? I'm just asking questions. Marilyn drops her teacup into the sink and turns on the water. An angry soap froth rises in the drain. Looking into all possibilities? He didn't even listen when I said it could be a stranger. Because you're acting hysterical. You hear one news report and you get all these ideas in your head. Let it go. James still hasn't lifted his head from his hands. Marilyn, just let it go. In the brief silence that follows, Hannah slips under the table and huddles there, hugging her knees to her chest. The tablecloth casts a half-moon shadow on the linoleum. As long as she stays inside it, she thinks, curling her toes in closer, her parents will forget she's there. She has never heard her parents fight before. Sometimes they bicker over who forgot to screw the cap back onto the toothpaste, or who left the kitchen light on all night. But afterward, her mother squeezes her father's hand, or her father kisses her mother's cheek, and all is well again. This time, everything is different. So I'm just a hysterical housewife? Marilyn's voice is cool and sharp now, like the edge of a steel blade, and under the table Hannah holds her breath. Well, someone is responsible. If I have to find out what happened to her myself, I will. She scrubs at the counter with the dish towel and tosses it down. I would think you would want to know too. But listen to you. Of course, officer. Thank you, officer. We can't ask for more, officer. The foam chokes its way down the drain. I know how to think for myself, you know. Unlike some people, I don't just kowtow to the police. In the blur of her fury, Marilyn doesn't think twice about what she's said. To James, though, the word rifles from his wife's mouth and lodges deep in his chest. From those two syllables, kowtow, explode bent-backed coolies in cone hats, pig-tailed Chinamen with sandwiched palms, squinty and servile, bowing and belittled. He has long suspected that everyone sees him this way. Stanley Hewitt, the policeman, the checkout girl at the grocery store. But he had not thought that everyone included Marilyn. He drops his crumpled napkin at the empty place and pushes his chair from the table with a screech. I have class at 10, he says. Below the hem of the tablecloth, Hannah watches her father's stocking feet, a tiny hole just forming at one heel, retreat toward the garage stairs. There is a pause as he slips on his shoes, and a moment later the garage door rumbles open. Then, as the car starts, Marilyn snatches the teacup from the sink and hurls it to the floor. Shards of china skitter across the linoleum. Hannah stays absolutely still as her mother runs upstairs and slams her bedroom door, as her father's car backs out of the driveway with a mechanical little whine and growls away. Only when everything is completely quiet does she dare to crawl out from under the tablecloth to pick the fragments of porcelain from the puddle of soapy water.